So nice to have you back late.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yeah. And let's get started with the latest interactions between Israel and Hezbollah. We had a preemptive attack on Hezbollah, and later on we had the response coming from Hezbollah. What do we know so far from these attacks?
Well, the Israelis claim it to be a preemptive attack, but it was clear that the firing of Hezbollah on the Zionist colony as retaliation for the assassination of General Fuad Shukr began before the Israelis started firing on South Lebanon. So there is no such thing as a preemptive attack. The second thing that we know is that Hezbollah fired around 340 missiles and tens of drones on the 11 bases in north of Palestine and in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. And that distracted all the air defenses of the Zionist colony for advanced drones to hit two major targets in the heart of the Zionist colony. One of them is the Glilot base, just 10 kilometers east of Tel Aviv, outside the municipal borders of Tel Aviv. And this is where the Israeli military intelligence services, the Amman, are headquartered, where also Unit 8200, part of the Israeli military intelligence apparatus that is responsible for planning and executing assassinations and what have you, was also the target. And the second target that the Hezbollah hit in their attack was the major air dispatch base in the north of Palestine, halfway between Tel Aviv and the border of Lebanon. And this would be the location where the orders were given to the Israeli jets or drones that hit the Lahia in Beirut in the assassination of General Shukr. Since that day, Israel has instituted a total media blackout, so no local or international media is allowed to film the Glilot base and or the air dispatch base and or find out about damage and or deaths within the ranks of the Israeli military. And also we had the head of the 8200 unit tendering his resignation. So we could speculate from him tendering this his resignation that clearly there was something hit the major building, maybe of the 8200. There must have been some casualties within the ranks of this unit. And I would say overall, what happened that day shows us that the Israeli intelligence were unable to predict the attack, where it's going to come from, and they were not able to actually even destroy the missile batteries and or the drone hangars where the attacks came from in South Lebanon. So this is compounded failures, intelligence and operational military failures. So this is the roundup of what happened that day. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah spoke after and told us that the Air Force, the Israeli Air Force, in their 40 somewhat raids on South Lebanon that day hit only two batteries for Katyushas after they were used and abandoned by the Hezbollah warriors, because Hezbollah, you know, expected these launchers to actually be hit. And in fact, he said these launchers would cost them less than $10,000, between $8,000 to $10,000, and that the lives of their members are more important. So even during the attack, they were not able to. And after the attack, Israelis were only able to hit two Katyusha launchers, which are very cheaply made.
Yeah. From Nasrallah's speech, what do we learn from their strategy right now? What were the key points of his speech?
It's clear that Hezbollah and the axis of resistance as a whole, while wanting to maintain deterrence against the Zionist colony, have no intention of letting themselves be dragged into a regional war. And the reason is because they see that their role as a support front, that the Palestinian resistance in Gaza up until now is still together and has weapons and is still resisting and is not defeated or anywhere close to be defeated. Therefore, the collapse of the Zionist colony is going to come if you just continue in this war of attrition without maximizing the death fields and dragging the whole region into a regional war, which is the intention of the Israelis. The Israelis are already militarily defeated in Gaza. They are going wild in the West Bank over the last 6 days and still actually being kind of militarily matched in the West Bank. They're losing soldiers in the West Bank in these cities that are been under siege for decades also there. So if the Axis of Resistance is able to drag this on as a war of attrition, Israel will collapse internally. Now we see Netanyahu wanting to drag the US into this war because he knows he's defeated. The Zionist colony knows it's defeated and it needs the US to directly come into this war to save off its collapse. So the Axis of Resistance is not falling for this trap. And we can see also a second thing about the strategy of taking time with the response. One was for building up the defenses of the Axis of Resistance in the eventuality of responding and the Israelis or the Americans hitting back, that you have to be ready for a hit back from the enemy. And the second was because they wanted to stretch the resources of the whole Western alliance, imperial alliance in the region. It's been now a month and a week or two since the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Iran, for instance, in Tehran. And we have, probably half of the navies of NATO still parked in the area, spending their money and wasting time and so forth. And all their resources and attention from media to intelligence is concentrated on this area. So that's in itself a war of attrition effort. And so when the attack of Iran comes, we should also expect it to fit the same kind of value that Hezbollah did. They will hit the parts of the Israeli military and intelligence services, security services that were responsible for the assassination of Haniyeh. They will make sure to get deterrence back, but not make fall into a full-out war. And again, we see because Netanyahu and the whole Zionist establishment wants to drag the region into a regional war, even those calculations by the Axis of Resistance may not work. The Zionists may provoke something, do something that will drag us anyways into a full-out war.
Yeah, it seems that one of the reasons of bringing the United States into the conflict and having a bigger war with Iran and Hezbollah. On the other hand, recently we've seen that Netanyahu in his talk, when he was showing the map of that region, there was no West Bank in that. It's unbelievable. And it seems that he's going to do the same to Gaza if something big happens between Israel and Hezbollah or Iran. And this is the main goal in their mind. How do you think, and considering his latest talk, and he was talking about that we are going to remove Hamas totally. And how is the situation? How is the position of Hamas right now?
Well, first off, I think the Zionists themselves claimed maybe in the last 2 days that Hamas was able to recruit 3,000 to 6,000 new recruits just in the last few months. So there's Hamas's ranks, the military wing, the Qassam brigades are just growing. I mean, you have people that are in Gaza that are watching their children, their wives, their sisters, their brothers, their parents being slaughtered. Of course, Al-Qassam brigades will have a very easy time recruiting and people will be running to it to carry arms in order to defend their families and bring justice to their losses. So no, Hamas is actually in a very good position. I think people must understand that even though that the majority of weapons that Hamas is using are manufactured inside Gaza, under the grounds of Gaza, that actually the smuggling of weapons to Palestine, to Gaza specifically, is continuing. The Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah, and the Syrian military mainly are continuing to bring in weapons to Gaza under the mass bombardment that we see and the all the presence of the whole Western military and intelligence apparatus and the regimes that collaborate with the Zionists in Egypt and Jordan. Even in the West Bank, there is a flood of weapons coming in, all thanks to the Syrian military and its revolutionary position on this situation. So no, Hamas is not weaker. In terms of Netanyahu, his press conference that he held yesterday, this was one of the triggers of these mass demonstrations that we saw last night, the largest demonstrations against Netanyahu since the beginning of this war. And the other part of the reason that there was these huge demonstrations is because Abu Obeida, the spokesperson for the Qassam Brigades, you know, sent a message and a video saying that there is now a change in the policy of how the Palestinian resistance deals with Israeli prisoners of war. In the case of a situation where the Israeli military is close to, you know, getting to the location where these prisoners of war are, the order is to execute them immediately. There is only now two choices for these Israeli prisoners of war to come back to their families. One is through a exchange of prisoners of war deal. The other is in coffins. There's no third. There will be no more ability of the Israelis to free these prisoners of war. And these, the last six prisoners of war that included one of them being an American dual citizen that's served in the Israeli military, they were executed by Hamas. This is now the announcement that we had. And they released their videos, messages from these prisoners of war to their families before this Israeli operation, an attack on the location they were being held. And that, along with Netanyahu's press conference that clearly said that he doesn't care about the prisoners of war, that he's going to continue until the full destruction of Hamas, triggered these huge demonstrations, and we see how the messaging of the resistance is actually more effectual on the Israeli public than even Netanyahu's attempted, you know, graphics press conferences that he had. And about the West Bank being missing from this map in his press conference, well, it's clear Netanyahu and with Trump as a president have annexed the West Bank, and they are have an approval to genocide the Palestinians in the West Bank, ethnically cleanse them like they are doing in Gaza. It started, by the way, today. The Israeli government is going to withdraw all the residency cards of all Palestinian refugees that reside from the West Bank that reside in Jordan. And so Jordan is going to suddenly find itself with close to 500,000 Palestinians being kicked out of the West Bank into Jordan. And that's going to trigger something. And this shows you how it's already in effect. The ethnic cleansing campaign is in the West Bank is already in full scale.
Yeah. In your opinion right now, how Hezbollah sees the, pardon me, how Hezbollah sees this situation within Israel and the situation, because it's so important to understand what's going on right now in Israel in order to have a better strategy to confront them. Do they really understand? Do they really follow what's going on in Israel militarily and economically?
I think, according to Israeli media, they say that there's nobody on this planet that understands Israeli society more than Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. This is according to the Israeli media. They believe that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah understands Israeli society more than themselves, okay, as media, as and their politicians. And so it's clear there is, Hezbollah has think tanks, has, you know, units that are translating every Israeli media outlet on the minute by minute as it's coming out, and they're looking at how this society is eating itself up. They can, you know, from where I'm sitting here, I can see a full purge being conducted by Netanyahu, for instance, that most people in the West don't understand what's happening inside Israel. Netanyahu, since the beginning of this genocide in Gaza, has managed to purge all the old Ashkenazi, quote-unquote, secular Zionists that founded the state from much of the government civil service and apparatuses, including in the Supreme Court that was, you know, bothering him before October 7th. If our viewers remember, there was all those demonstrations before October 7th because his attempt to, you know, take over the Supreme Court. Well, he did it during and since the October 7th, and nobody did anything about it. And now the religious Zionists, like the Ben-Gvirs and the Smotriches, are in control of all the civil service and the Supreme Court and the judicial system. And the last holdout for these old, you know, secular Zionists, quote-unquote, Ashkenazis, is the military officer ranks. Not even the soldier ranks are now dominated by these old secular Ashkenazis. Now, actually, the soldier ranks are dominated by the fascist religious, like the Ben-Gvirs and Smotriches. And there is a fight within the military where Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich are trying to give raises and, you know, new ranks to members that they believe should, and take out the older ranks in the officers. And we saw already the resignations of the Commander-in-Chief and the Minister of Defense just before. And I think these new ones that are there, who still are part of this old guard, are going to resign and step down. So there is a full one-party kind of rule that is coming in all of the parts of the society. And that is, you know, translating into these huge demonstrations in the streets and or the calls by the Hestradot, the Israeli National Labor Union, for a general strike, because again, still the Hestradot is, you know, from the old guard. So, you know, this is going to play out in the streets of the Zionist colony, and it, as we're seeing, it's becoming more and more violent. And at some point, within the military specifically itself, there is going to be only two paths forward. Either the old guard steps down and doesn't fight, and it's going to be all the Netanyahu Ben-Gvir kingdom inside the military, or there's going to be a mutiny and a coup. There is no third way possible, and we can see this playing out, by the way, in the diaspora of the, you know, the Zionists. This fight is also intensifying.
Yeah, the other thing that we've learned today, that Israeli army is moving their forces from the Lebanese border to the West Bank in Jenin, in the north of West Bank. And what's the importance of this move and what they're doing there and what's their strategy? Why do they need to do that?
Well, there now the Israeli military and security apparatus is declared the West Bank as an active war front. So now this is the only second war front that they are categorizing as such, which means that we are at war in the West Bank. It's not just like military operations on and off. No, no, this is going to be a full-out war. And if you look at the videos coming out on Free Palestine TV, we have now a reporter that's producing daily 2 to 3 reports from Jenin and the area around it. You can find all of that at freepalestine.video on the links to our social media. But what you can see there is a deliberate targeting of this cluster of towns and cities in the northwest of the West Bank, around Jenin, Tul Kerem, and Nablus, and a total destruction of all of the infrastructure. For now, almost 100% of all the streets, electricity, water, sewage, and telecommunications in the Jenin area and the Jenin refugee camp area are destroyed. They are targeting journalists directly. Yesterday, we shared this video of Israeli snipers firing at a car with journalists that was gathering at the location, going to a location to film in Kfar Din, in just outside Jenin. And they are also targeting ambulances. We showed a lynching of ambulance workers that happened, beatings of ambulance workers. And in fact, in Jenin itself, the day before yesterday, the Israeli military, driving a bulldozer, started chasing journalists with the bulldozers to crush them, all filmed. And then when the journalists hid in a shop, they were jamming their bulldozer through the shop. They wanted to demolish the shop on top of these journalists. So because the Zionists are emboldened that the West has allowed them to kill journalists, kill medical workers, kill aid workers, along with the tens of thousands of innocent civilians in Gaza, they believe they can do that also in the West Bank. And they are right. The West will allow them to do that. We saw yesterday the spokesperson of the Foreign Affairs in the U.S., first off, denying this idea of the map and refusing to say anything about what the operations are in the West Bank. Today, they started the Zionist operations around the south of the West Bank, around Khalil, Hebron, as it's called in English. And I think this is going to spread everywhere. So the Palestinians have now no choice but to militarily resist. And this is coming now, the calls from within the West Bank, calls on the Palestinian Authority to do something. There's national meetings of the Palestinian Liberation Organization that includes all the Palestinian factions except Hamas and Islamic Jihad that are voting right now to carry arms in the West Bank. And, you know, their Fatah, which is the party of Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, will have no choice if the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which they are part of, votes on this, but to follow suit.
Yeah. And the other conflict, the other important tension that we are having right now is in the Philadelphia corridor at the south of Gaza. And it seems that the United States is trying to do its best to just bring down the tensions between Israelis and Egyptian government and Sisi. How do you see, do you think that at the end of the day, the Egyptian government would accept what Netanyahu and his administration is doing in that part?
You know, right now, unfortunately for the Egyptian people, the proud Egyptian people, the government of Sisi is a total puppet of the West. They are not doing anything, and they will continue to do nothing until there is actually pressure within the country. But people are, of course, too scared to do anything inside Egypt because of the, you know, how ruthless the Sisi regime is. But I think if and only if there's a regional war that breaks out, that there is hope of change in Egypt. In a situation of a regional war, there will be big question marks on what is happening inside the Egyptian military itself. That's the only hope for any change is inside the Egyptian military. Are there going to be a rebellion by officers like happened in the 50s that brought us Jamal Abdel Nasser, the liberator of the Arabic people. So this is where the Free Officers Rebellion is the only model that could bring us any change in Egypt. And on that note, Sisi is just landed in Turkey, in Ankara, just a few hours ago. It was a surprise meeting, it seems like. And I think it has a lot to do with what's happening at the Philadelphia Axis and what's happening in the whole region as a whole. We saw what happened in Turkey, in the streets of Turkey just yesterday or the day before, I can't remember, when American soldiers were almost lynched, so that they were coming off an American ship that was patrolling the East Mediterranean and giving support to Israel. So we can see the streets in Turkey and Egypt are at a boiling point, right? And having these two vassals, puppets of the U.S., Erdogan and Sisi meet together, the Americans must be also worried where these, because a lot of times even puppets, the thing about puppets is that when they see a ship sinking, they jump off, okay? They don't go down with the master, right? So there's a very big possibility, because these are selfish individuals like Erdogan and Sisi, that at one point they will see that it is more beneficial for them, not even caring for their people or the will of their people, to stay in power and not be dragged into a war that is losing war to flip sides. And that's, I think, all of these changes could only be possible with the steadfastness of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the heroic actions of the Palestinian resistance on the ground that is not allowing Israel to win this war. This is what's changing the whole region. This is what's changing the whole world, the steadfast resistance of the Palestinian people.
Yeah. You mentioned the situation with the Jordan government, but do you think that they have some sort of leverage on when it comes to this issue with the United States and what's going on in the West Bank? Do they have any sort of leverage to put some sort of pressure on the Biden administration to just talk with Netanyahu and their policy and what they're doing right now in order to not making new problems for Jordan? How do you see the position of the Jordanian government?
Unfortunately, the Jordanian government has been the twin of the Zionist colony since its creation, right? So Jordan as a state was fabricated in order to have a buffer zone for the Zionist colony. This was the only reason that the British created this state that didn't exist before. And the king and the Hashemite family are not even Jordanian. They are from the Hejaz, from the Mecca region, right? And they came on the back of British army during World War I and occupied and controlled that land since that day with the direct authority of the British crown, the British military, and eventually the American military. There's so much American, British, and Western military on the ground in Jordan, and they are integral to the running of the Jordanian military and the Jordanian state as a whole, that there is no possible change. Even when I was talking just a minute ago on about Turkey and or Egypt flipping sides, that is possible. Jordan as a state flipping sides, that's in the realm of fiction, okay, of science fiction even, okay, because of how deep this role is of the state. And of course, people shouldn't forget that the king of Jordan, the current king, his mother is British, citizen. She's not even Arabic. And he only got into position of power because the first wife of his father was a Palestinian, and her children are not allowed to rule Jordan by a decree of the West. Even if they were collaborationists, there shouldn't be any hint of a Palestinian in charge in Jordan, even if they're collaborationists like Mahmoud Abbas. So this is not possible. And I think the Jordanian government is actually even more crucial to the defense of the Zionist colony than even Egypt. Because you could see how long the border line is between Jordan and occupied Palestine. It's the longest border, and how direct it is in contact with the West Bank. So if there is a government in Jordan that is not a vassal of the West, there would have been a flood of weapons inside the West Bank and inside 1948 Palestine. Palestinian citizens of Israel would be now drowned in weapons to fight. The resistance would have reached them. And, you know, this is why I don't think Jordan will change. And, you know, the last time there was some serious movement in Jordan was in 1970, when the September uprising of the Palestinians happened, and it came to be called Black September, when the Jordanian security slaughtered tens of thousands of Palestinians in the refugee camps there.
Yeah. And you've mentioned Turkey and Egypt. Both of these countries are influenced. The government is influenced by the people, by the public opinion. As we saw yesterday in Turkey, they're asking for the U.S. warship to leave Izmir in Turkey, because the presence of them, the U.S. warship, is because of Israel, to give support to Israel. That's why they're asking the United States to leave. And the same thing in Egypt, as you've mentioned, the public opinion just forcing the government to do what they wanted to be their foreign policy toward Gaza, toward Palestinians. But what do we know about the public opinion in Jordan? You talk about the government, but we have Jordanian people who are so important in this calculation.
Yes, and Jordan definitely has had the biggest and most continuous demonstrations against the genocide in Gaza outside Yemen. You know, it's Yemen and then Jordan in terms of these demonstrations. But, you know, Jordan and the Jordanian public have been conditioned. They have this special thing about the royalty. It's almost as annoying and ridiculous as how the British think about the royalty and their place. They're robbing the British public, but they all come out to their parades. Similarly, the Jordanian public, at least, has been conditioned in this way for 100 years. So there is, and also they're allowed to go out in these demonstrations, right? So there's some mechanisms of releasing the pressure in the street. And because of the Arab autumn and the killing fields in Iraq and Syria and Libya, a lot of people in the Arabic world, not only in Jordan, are worried about pushing for change. They're scared that it's going to be ending up like killing fields like Iraq and Syria and Libya. So there's multiple things that play at why the, number one, the Jordanian public doesn't become more radical. Number two, on why is the Jordanian government so stable and unchallenged? And, you know, part of it is the presence, huge presence of Western military and intelligence inside Jordan, and the flooding of the Jordanian economy, because Jordan doesn't have anything that is producing really other than tomatoes that is exporting to the Zionist colony. But the economy stays afloat through money coming from the West artificially. Those are all aspects of why there is, I think, no change possible in Jordan's position.
Yeah. And the other thing would be, right now, how Iran and Hezbollah are thinking of the future of the conflict, because with the rise of Donald Trump in the United States, I think that they have to just modify their strategy and they have to rethink, because we know that what would be the foreign policy of Donald Trump when it comes to Gaza and Israel. And we also know what would be the Kamala Harris foreign policy. She's trying to do just the same as the Biden administration was doing for more than 10 months in this conflict in Gaza. But and in this new strategy, we have to consider the role of Saudi Arabia and UAE, which were so close to the Trump administration in his first term. And right now, do you think that with the new talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia, between Arab countries and Saudi Arabia, are they capable of keeping the control over Saudi Arabia or keeping the friendship the way that wouldn't go the same way that we had in the first term of Donald Trump, just Saudi Arabia going against Yemen, going against Ansar Allah and Houthis?
Yeah, I mean, look, there is not much real difference between the position of Kamala Harris and Trump on Palestine. In fact, I would say, you know, we remember Trump was interviewed a couple times in the beginning of this genocide about the situation, and he said he would have allowed basically the Israelis to do it all at once, end it. Okay, so that's really the difference. The difference is that Trump would want the genocide to happen as fast as possible, and he's fine with it. And the Democrats want it to happen incrementally and stretch it, and they want to pretend that they are trying to do something to stop it. That's the only difference, okay? You know, Trump is the one that, you know, declared the Golan Heights and the West Bank and East Jerusalem as part of Israel, right? So the Democrats also acknowledge it, but they don't want to admit it publicly. They want to pretend that they are still not fully on board with that while they are funding the building of the colonies in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights. So it's all about aesthetic. The difference between Trump and Harris or the Democrats and the Republicans is aesthetics. It's a method of propaganda. That's all. The aims, the strategic goals of the empire, the United States, is to remain as the hegemon in the world and to remain to in control of the oil fields of the Arabic world and all the trade routes that pass through that land and seas around it. So that's a strategic goal of the empire. It's not the strategic goal of Trump or Biden or Harris, right? So what is going to change between these governments, or if they are in power, is the tactical choices that they will make to maintain the trajectory for their strategic goal. So I don't see a much difference in between the two. The other thing that I would say is that looking at what Trump did in his first term, we can see, you know, that he is actually more public about his support of genocide and supremacy in general. So he's the one that assassinated General Soleimani and almost dragged the United States into a full war with Iran on behalf of the Zionist colony, right? He said even in interviews that the Israelis were supposed to conduct the assassination with the Americans because the Israelis asked for it, and that at the last minute, while the operation is almost on way, the Israelis withdrew because they were too scared of the, or according to him, too scared of the response of Iran. But in reality, they wanted the U.S. to do it on their behalf anyways, just like now they want the U.S. to fight the war on their behalf. I don't see any change, no matter who comes into power in the United States, in terms of the fate of the people in Palestine and in the region as a whole.
And just to wrap up this session, Leith, my question is this: is the Islamic world aware of what's going on and what's at stake if Donald Trump wins? Because of the position of Saudi Arabia and UAE, they're so important when it comes to Houthis, when it comes to Yemen and Ansar Allah. How do you think, in your opinion, the Islamic world, I'm talking about Hezbollah, Iran, Sunni, Shia, all together, would manage that?
You know, the biggest corruption of Islam happened with the oil being found in these countries in the 1940s. And the funding of the Wahhabi cult that brought us Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And that all happened at the order and behest of the British and the Americans. And the regimes in these countries cannot exist without the direct involvement of the United States and the UK before them. In fact, look at the UAE, Bahrain, Qatar. These were fabricated city-states that were created in the 1960s and 70s. Bahrain, when it was fabricated by the British, it had, 45,000 citizens. That's it. It's like, you know, one block here in Beirut, okay? So these are not real states. These are imaginary states as much as Israel is imaginary. And, I personally say, don't even use the word Saudi Arabia. I say Saudi-occupied Arabia, because there's an Arabian people and there's the Saud family, that the Saud family's name is imposed on the Arabian people. Imagine if we don't call English people or British people, we call them Windsorians, okay? Or Windsorian England, we'd call it, or Windsorian Britannia, that's the name of the state, okay? So these regimes, from their inception, just like Jordan, just like the Zionist colony, were client regimes that were molded to make sure to maintain the control of these offices. It's impossible to straighten a dog's tail, they say. You have to chop it off, okay? But looking at how scared these regimes are of Ansarullah and the Yemen and the whole axis of resistance, and looking at the fact that the U.S. Bringing half of its navy and the West, Western Navy, is trying to fight Ansarullah and the Yemeni army have lost the war, I think those regimes are scared. They see their master in the White House getting a beating, broadcasted on international news. And this is their master that's supposed to protect them, allow them to continue to loot the resources of their people as long as the master gets the majority of the money, allowing them to run these fascist cult states that abuse their own citizens, abuse foreign workers, allow them to run these Wahhabi cult death squads that go and roam across the planet from Nigeria to China, blowing up things and killing civilians. These regimes cannot exist because they themselves are an aberration in history on their own citizens. They're an aberration on geography. I don't think, I go back to the fact that it's possible that Egypt and or Turkey flip sides. These are civilizational centers. These are societies that existed prior to colonialism. These are identities that existed prior to that. These are countries that had a history of being glorious leaders on the international stage, while little client, manufactured identities and states cannot fill that position ever.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Laith. Great pleasure as always.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be with you again.